directly to our second case, number 12-1193, Ameriprise Financial Services v. Smith. Mr. Skipper, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Matthew Skipper and I represent the appellant, Martin A. Smith. The sole question presented in this case is one of statutory interpretation. Appellant acknowledges that this Court's 1993 Sverdrup decision is directly on point, but today we are asking the Court to revisit that decision in light of the overwhelming weight of modern authority, finding that Section 9 of the Federal Arbitration Act establishes a firm one-year deadline by which a petition to confirm an arbitration award must be filed. Appellant's primary contention is that Section 9 is not vague, nor is it ambiguous, and that the plain language of the statute mandates the filing of a petition to confirm within 1 year after the award is made.
Mr. Smith, can I ask you a... You're not Mr. Smith, that's your client. Mr. Skipper, can I ask you a question about the facts? Has your client refunded the money?
My client has not paid any money to Ameriprise, right. Your Honor.
Okay, so you've retained the money, the other side wants the money. Do they, under the contract, do they get interest or attorney's fees or anything?
The promissory note, which is the original underlying obligation, does provide for attorney's fees. It does provide for interest at a rate slightly above prime, and there are provisions like that that Ameriprise petitioned the trial court for in the inclusion of the confirmation of the award.
And then what happened? I understand what happened on the merits, but is that still it? If you should prevail, you're not paying anything. If they should prevail, what happens?
If they should prevail, then the obligation would be confirmed as a judgment, and then they would essentially...
So they would get it. What I'm trying to get is, would they get attorney's fees? Would they get what?
Yes.
What
yes.
Besides the payment that your client received, would they get?
They would get attorney's fees, Your Honor. They would get interest. It was included. And my understanding is that they could potentially petition for the additional fees that they've incurred, but they would get attorney's fees.
There's no, and maybe you can help me with one other thing that. Question I had about the facts. They didn't ask for confirmation of the award within the 1 year. Was it because the parties were negotiating?
There is not evidence of that in the record. My understanding from my client is that there was no communication for 15 months.
They just forgot about it.
And that nothing essentially happened. The petition that they filed to confirm was solely under the authority of the Federal Arbitration Act. There is language, and I will address it later. There is language in Ameriprise's filings in this court where they seek to, in some ways, transform now at a later point this to a confirmation at law, which is an alternative that the Sverdrup Court relies on.
I'm sorry, if you just talk up a little bit, a confirmation?
I'm sorry, a confirmation at common law, which is an alternative that the Sverdrup Court relies heavily upon, and I will get to that. But as we stand now, the original judgment entered by the trial court did include attorney's fees and interest, and it was filed untimely. And
it was filed under the Arbitration Act?
It was filed under the sole authority of the Federal Arbitration Act, right. Appellant's primary contention is that Section 9 is not vague or ambiguous, and that the plain language of the statute mandates the filing of a petition to confirm an arbitration award within 1 year after the award is made. Alternatively, if this court finds that there is ambiguity in the statutory text, the so-called mandatory interpretation is the best interpretation of Section 9, given the Supreme Court's Cortez-Byrd decision, which notes that use of the word may in a statute does not necessarily connote permissiveness. Appellant will then show how the mandatory interpretation of Section 9 best advances the twin purposes of arbitration, finality, and judicial economy. And lastly, we'll show how the permissive interpretation advanced by Ameriprise aids large corporations and furthers the inequity that can, at times, exist in arbitration. Basic canons of statutory construction clearly indicate that Congress intended Section 9 of the Federal Arbitration Act to establish...
Can I go back to Cortez? It did...
Sure.
Cortez didn't directly overrule our Fourth Circuit precedent, did it?
No, not directly, Your Honor. What Cortez Byrd was an argument over the venue provisions under the Federal Arbitration Act. The venue provisions use both the word may and must interchangeably, and the question there was whether or not the venue provision in the Federal Arbitration Act exempted or restricted the general venue statute. The question was whether or not a petition to confirm had been filed in the appropriate court. And there, the court held that it was permissive which on its face seems to support Ameriprise's contention, but in finding it permissive, the court relied on distinctions that have no place in this dispute, that are not in no way really relevant. They talk about needless tension that it would create within the Federal Arbitration Act. One example they used was, say, parties file in the district court, but they didn't have a right to. They were required to arbitrate. What commonly happens is then there's the defendant will file a stay, and they'll ask to arbitrate the case. In that instance, under the general venue statute, if they had jurisdiction in that original, say the defendant resided in the venue, then the court would say, we'll stay the case. And then there's a Supreme Court case, it's called Marine Transport, that says any court that had jurisdiction originally then has jurisdiction for post-arbitration award confirmation. So if you had jurisdiction originally, you stayed the case, then you have jurisdiction later in the case to enter the confirmation. The rule that Bill Harbert Construction, the opponent in Cortez Byrd, was seeking would have made that not possible. Go ahead, Aaron.
What's your best argument that Cortez implicitly overturned our precedent?
The best argument, Your Honor, is the language that they use to talk about May. And this is the quote, although May could be read as permissive in each section, as Cortez Byrd argues, the mere use of May is not necessarily conclusive of congressional intent to provide for permissive and discretionary authority. In interpreting Cortez Byrd, which was a 2000 case, PhotoPaint, which is a case I'm relying heavily upon today, PhotoPaint said essentially that distinction, that heavy reliance that Sverdrup used on the word may, is not necessarily the way it is. It's not necessarily the way we see it, especially given Cortez Byrd.
Well, you're familiar with there's a whole line of Supreme Court law that says you must follow precedent unless you have a clear decision to the contrary.
Yes.
From the Supreme Court. You assert that this is this clear decision to the contrary? I don't think you go that far.
I don't go that far.
So we are really obliged to follow circuit precedent now, aren't we?
We'd argue that we have a good faith basis for overturning it, and that the 1993 case was incorrectly decided, and that the overwhelming weight of modern authority since that time has supported it. District court judges in this district have found the same way. Judge Andre Davis basically refused to apply Sverdrup because he said it's a candidate for reconsideration by the Fourth Circuit. Given Cortez Byrd and PhotoPaint, we firmly believe that, and I'm summarizing his words, that it's a candidate for reconsideration, and I don't think it's good law anymore. Multiple trial courts in districts where they have no appellate decision. Right now, the way that I read the law is that the Fifth Circuit and the Second Circuit have weighed in and on the 1 year and called it a firm 1 year deadline, whereas the Fourth and the Eighth Circuits have called it permissive. What we call
the Eighth Circuit has basically adopted our rationale without
in a very short opinion, in about a paragraph. All of the other circuits have no binding law on this, and the trial courts essentially have to figure it out themselves every time that they're confronted with
this
decision.
Did you make this argument in the trial court?
I did not represent the appellant.
Was the argument made?
The argument was made in briefing. There was no hearing. He simply relied on the one-year deadline and claimed only the statute of limitations. Further, I think one of the more important arguments supporting our position is that our interpretation is the only way to give effect to all of the statutory text. I don't believe that Ameriprise or any of the people that have been in their shoes previously, any of the parties, have ever given a good explanation for what within 1 year a party may apply. What does that mean? Absent our interpretation that it's a firm statute of limitations, there's no real argument. And even the Sverdrup court, in finding that, said that basically we're rendering it meaningless. But they found a conflict between two canons of statutory construction that I believe was a conflict of the court's own making. That they said that, number one, we have the ordinary normal use of may, which they relied on heavily and I believe has been undercut by Cortez Byrd. But on the other hand, we have the idea that we're not going to render any statutory language superfluous. So we have these two conflicting canons of statutory construction. They deemed those two conflicting ideas to make the statute vague, and then they went in and did various analysis in the history and purpose of arbitration and things like that, which we agree is the appropriate way to go about things if the statute is vague, but we don't believe it is. We believe that may simply only talks about the discretion of a party to apply to the court for confirmation, that a party may apply to the court, they may not. They may settle it, they may negotiate it, they may in some ways reach some kind of agreement where they don't apply. It's not a requirement of the Federal Arbitration Act, if you're governed by those principles, that you apply to the court. But if you may, as you may do, you have to within 1 year. And that is what we submit as a logical explanation of the statutory language. I used in the brief, and not to oversimplify, but essentially a parent looks at a child and says, you may go to your friend's house, but be home by 9 o'clock. You know, the child would never, ever be heard to say, well, Father, you use the term may and it connotes permissiveness, so I thought 10:30 was okay. They would never get there. The fact is that the parent said, you may go, you may not, you may decide to stay home, but if you go, you have to be home by 9 o'clock. That's exactly what Congress said. One court said Congress says what it means and means what it says. And for the Sverdrup case in 1993 to essentially just render an entire portion of the statute meaningless, to me, was a mistake and an error of law. There is an interpretation, our interpretation, which gives full effect to all the language, while at the same time optimizing the normal usage of the term may. That may applies to the discretion of the parties, whether or not to confirm, but if they do, they need to do so within 1 year. Another mistake that I believe the 1993 Sverdrup Court made was that after they looked at and relied heavily on the use of may, the next thing they said is essentially no harm, no foul. There's an alternative remedy, and they called it common law. That is not at issue in this case because it was not pled at the trial court, but more so it differs significantly between the states. Some states, 12 to be exact, have one-year statute of limitations for the filing of common law arbitration awards. Some of these rules have been codified and others have not, but some of them have essentially adopted the breach of contract statute of limitations, and there are various other limitations, but the point is that state procedure for confirming an arbitration award differs so variably between the different states. The Federal Arbitration Act was supposed to give a uniform body of substantive arbitration law. That was one of its primary purposes. And the fact that that was its purpose, then if we essentially default by saying there is no deadline, there is no mandate, if we essentially default to state law and to the statute of limitations that they impose, then in no way are we creating a uniform body of arbitration law. Some of the common law defenses that could potentially present themselves void is against public policy, incapacity to contract, duress, fraud, and fraud in the inducement. A lot of times we're talking about very large companies like Ameriprise or Merrill Lynch as compared to an employee, and they present the employees, they say, here's a signing bonus, here's this opportunity to our company, sign this, everything will be governed by arbitration that we involve ourselves in every day. We know the arbitrators, we know the process, we are very tight with FINRA, and at the same time, they don't know you, you'll probably never be there again. And that is essentially our policy argument, is that by adopting a permissive interpretation, which I'm not really certain that Ameriprise or anyone else has ever delineated an actual statute of limitations, that if it's not 1 year, what is it? We don't know. Maybe it goes on forever. Maybe there's an analogous state statute that we adopt. We're not certain. But essentially, there's no limiting principle. And no way does that advance the purposes that arbitration is supposed to advance. Finality, the ending of the disagreement, and judicial economy. Because if it just goes on forever, an action at common law, an action not under the FAA, but an action at common law, is far more burdensome and far more cumbersome in court. It's a use of far more judicial resources because it's essentially an entire case. There could potentially be discovery. You have to sue on the contract. All the defenses I lifted previously still exist. And it's in no way is that advancing judicial economy, which was one of the purposes of the Federal Arbitration Act. The Supreme Court called Federal Arbitration Act confirmation a confirmation shortcut, because before 1925, there was always the ability to confirm an arbitration award. But at the advent of the Federal Arbitration Act, they called it a shortcut because it was meant to eliminate all those defenses. It was meant to streamline the process. It's essentially called a summary proceeding. And in return for that summary proceeding and the elimination of all the defenses I listed, what you get is the obligation to file within a year. If you're gaining this, you're gonna file within 1 year because we're trying to streamline the process and make everything quicker.
Where do you get that? There's some sort of legislative history that says that?
There is history in the Federal Arbitration Act that says it's supposed to be a streamlined process. It's the case, and I'm out of time. I'd like to finish, Your Honor.
Now you are.
There's a case, it's called Hull Street Associates, LLC versus Mattel.
It says that because you have this streamlined process, you have to do it within a year?
I'm stretching there. I apologize.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you very much. Mr. Swanson?
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Troy Swanson, and I represent Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc. In this case, it's interesting to note that a petition to confirm the arbitration award was filed. A summons was issued by the district court. Summons and the petition were served upon the defendant in this case. And then there was a short discovery period, and then another motion was filed to confirm our motion requesting for judgment on the award, and ultimately an order was entered. The whole process took approximately a year.
When did you file to confirm the award?
To
when the award was granted.
It would have been December of 2010 and I believe July of 2011 or
did more than a year expire?
It was more than a year that it expired. I mean, since the award was done? I mean, since the confirmation of the arbitration award or the arbitration award itself?
There is an award, right?
Correct.
You go to arbitration and
there's
an award.
We were outside the 1 year on confirming the award, relying on...
I wasn't understanding from your recitation of the facts. Oh. You were suggesting that you'd gone in to confirm before the 1 year limitations period.
No, Your Honor. What I was trying to state was...
Okay.
There was the award of confirmation.
Okay.
Then, after a year... There was a petition to confirm the award. A summons was issued.
Okay.
Then the summons was served, okay. And then later...
Is there anything in this record that tells us that there was any action that took place within that first year?
No, there's nothing in the record within that year. I do understand that there was some talks before that time and that at some point in time it was brought to my...
Among your clients?
Correct. And they're relying on this on Fourth Circuit decisions as far as... filing or confirming this award.
Is there any issue in this case other than the authority of the Fourth Circuit opinion? And, I mean, it is the case, right?
That's correct. No, there is some other authority that I have. And
No. But if your position is the Fourth Circuit case is controlling.
Correct.
You live and die on that, right?
That's correct.
Just to follow up on that, I suppose while we're sitting here today, the en banc petition was denied. And I guess it was to flesh out anything else in the record before there is a petition en banc, which there more than likely will be. So is there anything else that we need to know?
Oh, yes. As far as the facts of the case or the arguments?
Either one.
Okay. Well, with respect to the argument...
In other words... Is there anything you need to tell us now?
Yes.
That would save you on an en banc petition?
Yes.
In other words, if we went the other way and we did away with the Fourth Circuit precedent, what additional facts or law would save you?
In this particular case, the elements for confirming the award are the same elements that you'd be entitled to under common law. I don't believe that appellant counsel was correct when they said you would have to go through the whole process again. I mean, this Sverdrup decision discussed in detail about how petition to confirm awards were routinely done based upon the award itself, and that this summary proceeding was shorter, but you could still go on the judgment or the legal proceeding to say this, in fact, I can do this under regular law as well, under common law. And the court recognized it, and it also stated that the Arbitration Act didn't supersede it, and you could still go under common law. And that was acknowledged, I believe, also with the Kentucky case that the Sverdrup decision relied upon. And in that situation, they stated that, we went on the situation of enforcing it under common law. But in common law, basically all you have to do is go through the legal proceeding. It's a legal proceeding as opposed to a summary proceeding.
Well, when was the arbitration award made? when the date of the arbitration award?
Date of the arbitration award.
Let's see here.
My question is limitations run?
Limitations may have run over on the 3 years. The promissory note, I believe, may be under seal, which would extend it to 12 years. I did not handle the arbitration. I just handled the confirmation of the arbitration.
Well, we weren't there either.
I know.
It's your case.
Understood. But I believe that the promissory note did have a under seal provision in it, which would extend it to 12 years. But in either event, I'm assuming that maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. You know, it's...
Well, but if we go to my colleague's question, what we want to know is one of the things the panel hearing does before on bank hearing is to narrow issues. And we want to know if there's any other issue in play in this case. Yeah. Now, you never did file a common law action, so I guess it's not in play right now.
Well,
right?
It could be considered to be a common law if you're arguing under the liberal rules of pleading, because the same elements that would have been done for a petition for confirmation would have the same elements for a common law.
You have authority that a petition to confirm an arbitration award constitutes a common law action?
No, but the authority would be under the basics of having, it's the same, the petition to confirm and a petition at law are basically the same facts. We have an award under confirmation. This was said by the Sverdrup Court.
Well, it's like basically blue is green, but because...
Well, no, one entitles you to get it immediately. One entitles you to get it immediately, where it says the court must handle this. And the other one takes time, where there has to be a summons served, a complaint filed, discovery. And discovery on the issues is not necessarily on the exact facts of the case, but on whether or not the arbitration was valid or not.
We have a term called equitable tolling in a lot of these limitation cases. Is there any factual basis for that to be considered in this case?
Facts for equitable tolling would be in consideration for having the same facts in the complaint or in the petition in this case, could also be considered to amend it to make it a complaint as opposed to a petition, because the facts are identical to confirm the award.
And there's no other basis that you would make any argument about equitable tolling?
No, equitable tolling as far as, equitable tolling of the statute of limitations in this case, it would be that if the complaint becomes dismissed, there wouldn't be equitable tolling. But if the complaint, if we're permitted to amend the complaint, especially given the fact that the Fourth Circuit had precedent in this on this particular issue on point, that we would be allowed to go back and amend our petition to make it a complaint, but we're not adding any additional facts to it.
Well, what if you filed today and for you filed to confirm the arbitration award today? Would that still be timely?
If I were to file it today?
Yes, it had never been filed before. You're not in this court, but you go and read the Fourth Circuit case, Sverdrup, and you decide that you're going to file today. Is it timely?
I would argue yes, it is.
Okay, and what if you file 10 years from now?
No. What is out there is you have a latches argument or something similar to a 12-year recording of a judgment statute.
And so in that 12 years?
Correct.
So 12 years. There's a 12-year statute of limitations.
Right, or
Implied.
Also, you have a latches argument where there's a reliance or a change of position in connection with thinking that this confirmation of award was entered or not entered, and then that would be a reliance issue, so you're dealing with a latches argument. So it may be shorter than that period if you can show that there's been a change in position. Meaning, for example, for a latches argument to apply, let's say, for example, that there was a reliance that this award was no longer going to be around, or a number of years had gone by, and he had changed his position, and they had gone back to work for Ameriprise, and then all of a sudden Ameriprise comes back and says, look, you know, we're going to enforce this now. And he says, well, look, you know, I waived my position. I went ahead and took a job with you. I took additional sums from you. We, you know, entered into some different employment agreements.
Money?
I'm sorry?
He had the money? you didn't come after it in a year and he spent it.
Well, we're not sure if he had. Well, no, he had the money and then he didn't have the money and then he was sued for the money.
Right.
It wasn't just, and then there was a petition for confirming the award of the arbitration.
But not within the year.
No, not within the year. Now, in connection with this statute also as well, I'd like to bring to your attention that there has been some relationship arguments to Section 207 of the Arbitration Act, which has to deal with enforcement of international judgments. And in that case, we understood that that statute actually, under Section 207, was an amendment in 1970, which postdated the actual statutes regarding arbitration or enforcement of arbitration, confirmation of arbitration agreements. And in that instance, they talked about a three-year statute of limitations in there. And it's interesting to note that a lot of the arguments that the Photoshop or the Photo Paint Court makes is that this statute says 3 years and some courts have enforced it as a three-year period. But it's interesting to note because it postdated this time period that the court also may be considering that, well, over here we have the Kentucky case out there, which is... In the Kentucky case out of 1956, in that particular case, predated, it was 1952. And in 1952, there weren't the amendments to the Section 207 of the Arbitration Act, which identified a four-year period for international...
Section 9, what does the phrase, within 1 year after the award is made, mean to you?
What that means to me is it means that the court must enter the award. And that's the way the statute reads. It says, it states that the court must enter the order. Whereas if it's outside a year, it still has the option to enter the order in that particular case. Because if it says may, within any time with 1 year, apply, then it says, if such application is made, then the court must enter the order with these limited defenses. And in that particular case, that's where that statute of interpretation come in, where that word 1 year can be handled. Also, in connection with the Cortez decision, the Cortez court came out and wasn't referring to the word may. What they were talking about was if you looked at the policies behind the Arbitration Act, and if that legislative intent and is controlling. And what they did was is they went ahead and they looked at all the words must and may throughout the statute. And you say, you know what, we can't determine whether or not it's a must or a may. The two sections collide. So what we're going to do is we're going to go and look at the legislative intent. Now, it's obvious here with all the different stats, the Eighth Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, the Second Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit, all out there, and the problems that they're all existing. What you have is you have a situation where it's ambiguous. May, must, shall. So what the court did in Cortez was they went and they looked specifically at the legislative intent and policy. Now this Fourth Circuit, this court was very intent on discussing that issue. And when they went through it, they stated in detail that any other interpretation was repugnant to the statute, to the Arbitration Act, meaning that they want to have fast enforcement procedures coming in, that they want to be able to confirm it, that you don't want to have to go out and go through another whole long year process just to confirm an award all over again. And that was important.
Can I ask you, in response to my colleague Judge Floyd's question about do you have anything else to tell us? You started talking about common law causes of action and 12-year statute of limitations. And I've been looking at your brief and the brief that was filed below, and I don't see any discussion of any of that.
You are
confined to the arguments that you make in your briefs, aren't you?
Well, you've asked me some questions, and I've answered the questions.
No, I appreciate that, but what I thought we were asking you is, do you have other arguments upon which you have relied? And you are confined, are you not, to the what arguments that you make to the court?
You made the
arguments in the red brief and the arguments that are in the record, right?
I thought that the question was, were there any additional arguments that you had outside?
Okay, but so you these are new arguments, though. You would acknowledge that.
Well,
they're not arguments that are in your brief.
No, the new argument is for under the Section 207 issue would be a new argument. You asked me a question, what does the 1 year apply to?
No. I'm going back to Judge Floyd's question about are there other, and you started talking about common law causes of action. And I don't see any reliance on common law causes of action in your papers. Would you agree with me about that? And if you wouldn't, show me where you talk about it. Seems to me you pretty clearly agree on serve drop. That's how you say it?
Correct.
And you agree on, you talk about the Supreme Court case?
Correct.
And that's all she wrote?
Well, I did talk about, on page 5 of my brief, talk about remedies do exist outside the Federal Arbitrations Act framework to enforce fugitive's reward. Reading Section 9 as a strict statute of limitations would be an exercise of futility. Instead of cutting off the rights of the parties to receive proceeds of arbitration, merely encourage at the expense of the judicial economy the use of another analogous...
So this is a long quote of serve drop, is that what you're talking about?
That's correct. And it talks about another analogous method of enforcing awards.
Let me ask.
Yeah, but try
to nail this down. Are there any facts in the record that caused you not to ask for the award within 1 year? Did the other side do anything to cause you to delay?
No.
Deceive you?
No.
You?
Okay. No. But the question was asked to me if you talk about analogous method of enforcing awards, and I would discuss that. And the question was brought to my attention with respect to, you know, about this common law awards, and I cited the case. It's very detailed throughout this Fourth Circuit opinion, and it talks about analogous method of enforcing awards. And this is what I'm talking about when I stated that the facts that we've alleged in the petition would be an analogous to a method of enforcing award, and that would be the common law provisions that are discussed in detail in this federal decision.
Well, the very beginning of this quote, though, says, because remedies do exist outside the Federal Arbitration Act's framework. So that suggests that you would do it outside, not use a petition to enforce an award as a substitute, as the same thing, as you told me a few minutes ago, as a common law cause of action. It's something outside the common law, is something outside the arbitration award. One doesn't substitute for the other, does it?
If the fact
just you say this is my overall pleading, and I will be to enforce the arbitration award, or to make a new common law action, or to file a case in federal court, or to file a case in state court. This is my overall one size fits all pleading. That's not the way the law works.
In this situation, if you have a complaint that states, if you have a complaint that states a statutory cause of action, but it also states a breach of contract within the action, the requested relief was and for other just and proper relief. If you still state that cause of action, the headings or other items in there, as long as the allegations are the same, can still form the basis of a cause of action.
Well, and in this particular true, but did you do that in your petition to enforce the arbitration award?
No, I didn't ask for the alternative relief in that particular situation.
Okay.
I'm asking the court that in the event that the court decides to overrule the Sverdrup decision, that it goes ahead and states that we're allowed to go ahead and amend our petition to make it a complaint, provided the same facts, the analogous issues are there for enforcing the award. We're not changing any facts. It would just be a common law cause of action, which would involve a summons that happened in this case, an answer which happened in this case, and also a motion. The only difference was we asked for a motion for judgment as opposed to a motion for summary judgment. So although that the petition asked for relief under this act, it also asked for and other just and proper relief in connection with our complaint. And the request was made that in the event that this court overruled this Sverdrup decision, that we go ahead, that the court allow my client to go ahead and amend it to make it a complaint. The facts aren't going to change. Situation's not going to change. the same operative facts, same everything that we have in there. It's just going to take a longer period of time. I'm sorry.
Do you have anything further?
In connection also with this situation that is here in this Sverdrup case, it talks in detail about the policies behind the Arbitration Act. And if you connect that with the Cortez decision, which really doesn't discuss at all or rule on any issue with regard to the time for filing a petition to confirm award, but the approach that it takes, the analysis that it takes, talks about the flexible, talks about the more liberal policy for a federal arbitration act and how that policy helps dictate it. In this case, it's the same more permissive approach as to the more strict approach in this situation. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Briefly, Your Honor, just addressing a few of the questions that you had posed him. The arbitration award was sent out by FINRA on October 1st, 2009.
The
petition wasn't filed until the 28th. It was about 15 months. If you'll look briefly at page 21 of the joint record extract, there's a statement that is uncontroverted in the record. Where my client says, I never received a call or email or direct communication from petitioner, their attorneys, Troy C. Swanson or Cohen and Swanson PC to discuss, negotiate, or renegotiate. There's no tolling argument, which is essentially what I think your question, Your Honor, was getting at. There's no tolling argument. He essentially admitted it, and that's important.
Can you just talk up a little?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yeah, I will. There is no tolling argument, and it's important because the photo paint court ended up ruling that the petition was timely even though it was outside the 1 year, but they relied solely on the tolling and the negotiation between the parties and a written agreement. That's not present in this case. The facts of that case are not this. Secondly, if we look at the original petition, paragraph 4 under jurisdiction venue says, this petition is authorized by the Federal Arbitration Act 9 U.S.C. Section 9. That's the sole authority that Ameriprise relied on when they filed this. They did not file it as a common law conference. There was no alternative count. There was no other basis. Further, because more than 3 years have elapsed since the original award, a lot of courts say that we look at breach of contract because that's essentially what arbitration is in common law. It's a contract, honor the contract. If you sue on it, it's a breach of contract action. And most courts have adopted analogous breach of contract statute of limitations for confirming a common law. And because more than 3 years has elapsed, we'd argue that, number one, this court has no authority and should not basically convert his petition. But even if he did, it would still be time barred. And that's essentially our argument. Cortez Byrd was not... I apologize. I want to talk briefly about the policy considerations, judicial economy.
You want to talk briefly about what?
About the policy considerations, Your Honor.
Policy considerations, okay.
Sverdrup, in my opinion, the second mistake it made after it assumed two canons of statutory construction to be in conflict, the second mistake it made was then applying the policy considerations that underlie arbitration, judicial economy, and finality. It basically applied them in a way that, in my mind, doesn't make sense, and I never heard a good explanation in how not having any statute of limitations or some that each individual court just makes up, how that actually produces finality, how that speeds up the process, how that helps us understand how a summary proceeding will advance quicker. And the example I used in the brief, and maybe it's an extreme one, is that someone files a claim against an estate 50 years after the petition, after the award was made. There's nothing that he said today, and there's no argument that I understand from the other side that would bar that, that essentially it would go ad infinitum, and it simply doesn't make sense.
Can I take you off your policy arguments for
sure.
One moment? As I understand your colleague on the other side, he said, well, even if we should reconsider Fourth Circuit precedent, he can make a common law action, and we should convert his... petition to confirm the arbitration award into a common law action. And you in your responsive brief say he didn't file an action of common law to confirm the award, and a court should not convert one cause of action into another at the belated request of a losing party. But you don't cite any authority for that proposition. Do you have any?
Only the general principle that what you don't raise in the trial court, you cannot raise upon appeal. He essentially admitted that he had never raised it in any of the
trials. A few sentences later, you talk about the doctrine of election of remedies.
The doctrine of election of remedies, res judicata, collateral estoppel. If we litigate this, and which we are, and we're at that point, if there's some conclusion, he should not be heard to essentially ask for a redo. It is our position that it's time barred. But even if it wasn't, it's my belief, and according to my research, that would be barred by one of those three doctrines. Do you have any other questions, Your Honor?
No. I don't think you understood my question. If we conclude that you're right about the Arbitration Act, as I understand your colleague's position, that's all right because he has other remedies, as we outlined in the Fourth Circuit precedent.
Mm-hmm.
And in response to that, you have a couple of sentences in your reply brief, but you don't give us any facts. You talk about the doctrine of election of remedies. You think that would preclude him from now pursuing a common law action?
I think that several things preclude him. First, I think that doctrine of election of remedies, res judicata, and collateral estoppel all could potentially stop him from pursuing a common law action. I also think that because we adopt a breach of contract statute of limitations for common law arbitration, that because more than 3 years have elapsed, I believe that also bars his claim. And that's
okay. We will come down and greet the lawyers and then take a brief recess.